Mike Rowe here with a few thoughts on my favorite sweatshirt, a classic zip-up hoodie that used to be navy blue but has since faded to what the fashionistas call a distressed indigo. It's 13 years old, soft as a flannel bathrobe, and after a few hundred dirty jobs, demonstrably and undeniably indestructible. This is the kind of sweatshirt girlfriends like to permanently borrow, but I've held on to this one because I got it from American Giant. American Giant makes all their stuff right here in the USA so they can control every link in their own supply chain. That matters, because when you buy American Giant, you not only get great quality, you create jobs for people in factory towns all over the country. No pressure, but if you give a damn about the business of making things in America, you got to support the companies who are doing it right. Go to American-Giant.com/Mike to get 20% off your first order. That's American-Giant.com/Mike.
Who you know fresher than ho? Riddle me that. The rest of y'all know where I'm lurking at. Can none of y'all mirror me back? You hear me rap, it's like Angie rapping his prime. I'm young H.O. Rap's great for dead.
It is 11:17 on a Saturday night. And we're back. I'm Blake Howard. Katie Walsh is with me as always, my undercover partner. She will never doubt me. Katie, thank you so much for being by my side.
Here, I'm here again. Always will be.
This is Miami Nice. This is a show that is what turning into a confessional for people who are obsessed and addicted with Michael Mann's 2006 masterpiece that continues to perplex even the man himself that it is called and lauded as a masterpiece by a growing group of fans. Thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you. But today, there's another person who has been appreciated often on this show and has grown sort of this organic reputation as an insightful, thoughtful, and incisive examiner of action films that actually gives them the platform that they deserve instead of relegating them to the sort of the junkyard, the $2 bin at the front of your local department store. This person sort of elevates it to high art, and sometimes we've even referenced his tweets, funnily enough, direct quoted him instead of quote tweeting, quote him in a podcast, because we just are huge admirers of everything that he does on the internet in usually the vacant and empty, soulless vacuum of Twitter. There are some buoyant, beautiful lights of insight and nice cool sort of campfires to go around and enjoy chats about movies that you love and just movies in general. And one is stoked by this man. It would not be Miami Nice if it couldn't be Miami Vice. Vice Victus, welcome to Miami Nice.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for the warm welcome. It's really great to be here. Just want to say, well, before we begin, I really admire what you guys do with this podcast. Really appreciate the support you guys have given me. It's been great. So yeah, thanks.
I'm an action Twitter lurker, and I always appreciate your tweets about action films and martial arts and war films from a learned perspective, because you are a veteran, and thank you for your service.
Yeah, thank you indeed.
And you know, I love action films, but I always feel like I totally appreciate action Twitter for, I feel like I learn something new every day, whether it's about choreography, blocking, fight choreography, martial arts, editing. And so I am the student in the action Twitter corner of the internet.
Well, as am I. You know, it's I'll give a few shout out to you. Like, for example, One Perfect Headshot, his account. I follow so many people who take screen grabs and excerpts from movies from, you know, years ago, decades ago, 1920s, black and white stuff. Yes. And you see the actual lineage of the action cinematography from then to now. You know, like the Buster Keaton and Jackie Chan. Mm-hmm. More than that, like all the kinds of elements we take for granted almost, or seem innovative now, have been done, you know, to certain degrees years ago. But I'm starting too deep already. Wow.
No.
But the point being that, you know, it's a whole movement.
Katie is calling you from a corner of action film Twitter where she's like draped in some kind of camouflage with the sniper rifle just down the scope, just checking it out from afar. You may not know she's not in there, but she's always watching, guys. She's always
outside. I'm outside looking in. Yeah, but it is interesting that you say that, Vice, about like the history of cinema, because when I was an undergrad, I did take an action and adventure cinema class, and a lot of it was looking at Buster Keaton films, looking at like The Perils of Pauline and the way that the cinema of attractions, you know, as it's called, you know, really evolved cinema from, you know, more than just like a little vaudevillian attraction to something that was, you know, interesting and telling a story. And obviously, because it was silent, you had to rely on like action and things that were going on in the screen more than dialogue or milling around. But yeah, it's so fascinating when you look at, you know, the simple machines, like, oh, we're going to use a lever, or we're going to like, you know, do a trick shot this way. And it's like, oh, people have been doing this since the silent era. So that's one way that I love to look at action cinema as well, is like from the historical perspective.
You also remind me of when I took a few film classes as well. We saw, it was African-American film studies class. So of course we had to watch Birth of a Nation. Yes. You know, it's kind of famous slash infamous for being like kind of the, how cinema truly began, like the form of it, the aesthetics and the technology of it all. You know, it's the same thing there. It's like there's the language of the action, the movement, but also the actual text, the theme of what it's saying, trying to say. In this case, you know, it's a horrible nightmare what it's saying.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's also kind of in line with how I think we treat action in some form today. And we'll get to this later on, but how all the how it reflects reality or how it manipulates reality too. So yeah, all this high level philosophical stuff, you know, it's in this, just on these stupid gun movies or whatever. But it's always been the way. It's always been that way. That's what's
right, about right, it. Right, right, right. Yeah, definitely.
I can't believe that so far we've talked about D.W. Griffith, Buster Keaton, and I'm about to drop Deleuze, who's a cinematic philosopher from France.
Yes.
So strap in, because here you go. the great, like, cinema's true poetic philosopher, Deleuze, wrote two books about the philosophy of cinema. One was called The Time Image, and one was called The Movement Image. And in The Time Image, he just talked about the manipulations of cinematic time the passive viewer takes it for granted what you're seeing. So if we go back to the general, we talked about Buster Keaton, I feel like his is such a time and movement image, because he makes you relish in the almost like surgeon timing of that he has executed something over here, and we're going to watch it for that full 30 seconds that a train is going to fly off a bridge into a river, and it has one time to make it right, and he's going to do it. And that's like the miraculous level. But movement is like, you know, when you're sitting in your seat, that like almost virtual reality sort of perspective of being able to move with characters, move through, you know, time and space as well. And he writes really in, you know, detail and deep about it. And I think that in a couple of reasons, you see the laziest versions of action cinema are those that overtly manipulate time to cut corners, or overly manipulate movement to cut corners. Whereas I think the stuff I've relished reading about from One Perfect Headshot, from Vice, and there was a recent run on Action Film Twitter that was really appreciating all of the Kickboxer sequels with Scott Atkins. And I was like, the Undisputed sequels with Scott Atkins. Sorry. Yeah. Thank you for correcting me. But I was like, those Undisputed sequels going through, and I was like, the cinematic craft of these things have probably completely been missed by every mainstream critic that's looked at it. They haven't even thought about the action cinema. But then you see how other filmmakers who have got action in their films ape from those films. Like, oh, that works, I'm going to take that. That's going to be mine. It's like the worst lesson that everyone learned from the Bourne series. Let's just shake the camera. That's the action, right? And Paul Greengrass is like, that's not kind of what I was doing, but you know, go hard, whatever you guys want to do from now on, you know? So yeah, it's really fascinating. And it's a nice patch of Twitter to be in when you can appraise and appreciate it, because it's such like, it's popcorn cinema is action cinema, right? It's like, and nothing annoys you more when there's bad action in a big movie.
Oh
yeah. It's like, you know, everybody hates talking about the Marvel movies, MCU, but like I find them fascinating. I actually wrote a list of you people a couple years ago, you know, top ass whoopings in the MCU, you know, like, based on specifically the fight scenes. And to their credit, there are actually quite a number of good ones. Just so you know, that we kind of forget about it in all the CG or the set piece or the previous set stuff. But you know, like the Winter Soldier fight scene and even the TV shows like the Daredevil, the Netflix Daredevil series. You know, there's some actually really solid choreography.
Oh, that hallway scene in Daredevil season one was some special stuff.
Yeah, and even though I think they topped it too. Like people will kind of always mention that first season, but in season two there's a big stairwell fight with him against some like a motorcycle gang, and then the most recent season there was a big jailbreak, which was phenomenal, big like one take kind of crazy chaotic thing. It was amazing. They always got there's quality stuff in there. Just say what you will about the corporate machine and stuff, and you know we should say stuff about that, but you know there's room to appreciate the actual craft that all these people are bringing together in these projects. So that's worth mentioning as well.
I appreciate that approach, you know, the not tossing the baby out with the bathwater, but being like, what are the good moments in here and the little bright spots of something that's interesting or worthwhile to.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, you know, like millions of people are watching this regardless of what we think about it.
Totally.
Like, it's like, who was it? Herzog, like you said, you know, you must not look away. You know, this is, he's talking about Transformers or whatever. Like this is like the culture. You can't.
But he was talking about an artist, Michael Bay. That's why he said he couldn't look away.
Just like,
now this is the first time I'm saying it to Katie, but Katie and Vice, did you guys see the trailer for Ambulance, Michael Bay's new movie with Jake Gyllenhaal and Yaha? I was just like, and the tagline, it's actually produced by James Vanderbilt and Brad Fisher, the guys who produced Zodiac. It's been saying that like it's a remake of another film, but they're like, oh, it's like, you know, whatever, ever the comparisons to Heat have already started. But I'm like, oh, look, Michael, at least Michael Bay's out of robots and he's back to action. And like, let's just see what lunacy he can orchestrate.
I love Michael Bay. I think he's as a person, he's a total weirdo, but I love Michael Bay movies, especially the non-IP ones. I hate to like use IP as a phrase, but I love Michael Bay movies. He's a fucking madman. He's obsessed with cars. I'll watch that man choreograph some car chases any damn day.
Yeah.
And like do like low angle, like circling shots. John Krasinski totally stole for Quiet Place 2, but fine, whatever. But it's a good shot to steal. I'm totally down for Ambulance. I only watched half the trailer because I didn't want to see everything.
Yeah, no.
I'm actually kind of, now that I'm thinking about it now, it's kind of weird how formative Michael Bay is for me personally, like, you know, like all the Bad Boys things. You know?
Totally.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny that you hear the anecdotes about how he's like, I brought the black heroes to the mainstream, which is, you know, it's only a madman would say something like that out loud. You know? but it's also because it's true, you know, like if we were from getting Will and Martin to get action hero status to, you know, the famous scene in Bad Boys 2 where the, they were in the KKK gowns and then the guns akimbo for the burning cross. What a mad genius shit to do, you know? But also, this is another anecdote. I was in station in Germany for a couple of years. And during the time we saw Transformers 2, part 2, in the theater. It's in English, but they have subtitles in German. So we're there in the amongst the German populace watching this film. And of course, Transformers 2 is happening, unfolding before us. And then as it ends, you know, I kind of, this dawning dread of like, this is how they see us. This is how the rest of the world sees us. Here I am in the rest of the world in Germany. Yeah. And the crowd is like, they're kind of like, I couldn't even describe the feeling. They were like laughing. I feel like they, like, you guys are so stupid. Thank you, you're so stupid. So
I love that. Thank you for being so stupid. This is just exactly what I needed.
So I always kind of wrote that with me through my military career, like that presence of mind of how you, because it's actually a big deal, like amongst us, like whenever you're overseas, you're kind of an ambassador to other states, and also just me. Oh, in case you guys didn't know, listening, I'm black. So me being an African American, like off overseas, like I have other expectations of what I'm supposed to be. Now, I've been to Korea and Germany and Iraq, Afghanistan as well. So, like, I have that with me. At the same time, I have this mad, the id of America, Michael Bay is showing the world, having to contend with that, but also, like, you know, work with that too.
Yeah, that's so fascinating.
Yeah, it's
But those first three, this is the thing about Bay, the first three Transformers movies, whatever anyone wants to say about them, the craft is amazing. The other two are some of the worst example. The worst example, exactly as you said, that chaotic id, that like the Uber levels of stupid that they get to. And you know, when he can do that in unison with Marky Mark, I think we're all better for it, for just the conversations that can come out of it.
Well, but this is what I mean. It's like, you know, as I guess I'm kind of a proponent of the Transformers, Bayformers series in total, as the arc goes. So they're all like fascinatingly perfect to me, even though I hate them all for various reasons. Like when I saw part four, yeah, when I was in Afghanistan on a Russian bootleg. And so I'm there doing this mission, and I'm like, what am I doing here? What are we doing? What is society like? So, and then in the course of the Transformers films, the big films, they're like refugees turns heroes, mercenaries, like they're like pro-government cops. And then by part four and five, the government is trying to kill them all. It's this whole arc of like, and this arc, strangely enough, coincided with why I left the army in the first place. I left about 12 years. Like I was kind of realizing and seeing that I wasn't supposed to be here. We were not supposed to be doing this. This being the American Empire apparatus, and so like, so this is kind of why I have this weird. I'm such a defender of the Bay movies, and Bay is like he can see this, sense this subconscious powerful id of like how we're growing, how we're our attitude, you know, the 20 years of war, like he got it, he understood it through these crazy fucking robots, you know, like dude, like but he understood it more than like a lot clearer than the most, you know, most learned pundits could that I've heard, you know. He understood what I was feeling. And then so coming up to this his previous effort, Six Underground, when I reviewed that, it fucked me up, like because again it was like this more of this social political, not commentary, but like just the feeling of it, the verve of it, and this dumbass like Mission Impossible ripoff, you know, like he's so stupid, he's brilliant.
Yeah.
So now I saw the, I damn near had a fucking panic attack when I saw the ambulance trailer, because it was kind of now. So I've been out of the army for about 5 years now, and you know and of course the last 5 years happened.
Yes.
So I thought that, you know, I could kind of come home to peace, but that was not the case, as we all saw in the Trump era and everything happened.
Yeah.
Pandemic now even too. And fortunately for me, in my case, you know, I'm doing well. I've saved my money and I'm living with a wife, and you know, she does a good job. We're okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all know that the way that the Squid Game works, it could be all gone in a second.
The last 5 years is everyone's concern. Oh, especially right. the last two in both of our countries, right?
Yeah.
So I'm I'm seeing this like I don't know how or why or if he even cares, if Bay even cares, but he understands this on a very powerful animal level, this American experience of the past, the post 9/11 21st century American experience for all its, you know, faults and vices. he gets it. And I don't even know if he gets it. He gets it.
But
so yeah, also all of it to say there is no Bay slander allowed in the House of Vice.
No,
never. I stand Bay.
No, I can appreciate. I just can't stand those second two Transformers movies. But even talking to you right now, I might have to watch them again. But
Vice,
I would just
you need to write something on the Transformers movies and Michael Bay and Afghanistan. Like I need this long form essay ASAP.
And happy to play editing roles, both of us, Katie particularly. Yeah. As well, and the other thing I would say is, what you just gave the great point is that sometimes cinematic, sometimes your nation's cinematic champion is not your choice. You know what I'm saying? I'm trying to get to, like, for example. When you look at a certain period in Australian cinematic history, you know, when we talk about like some of my guys, Peter Weir, who is this beautiful, poetic filmmaker, very intelligent, makes these very kind of loaded, mysterious movies about the Australian experience before he starts to move abroad, and about the Australian experience, and particularly this hidden but also right in your face guilt of like, what the hell is this place, right? Like, what, we're here over a First Nations country, what are we doing? And then they give him Gallipoli. Like, they give this really intelligent guy what's meant to be this big rah-rah, you know, nationalistic, you know, our iconic national film. And he kind of maybe makes one of three anti-war movies that have ever been made. Like, at the end of it, none of it feels good. And actually, Australia doesn't feel good. And in fact, the colonial experience from British colonialism doesn't feel good. None of it feels good. And in that moment, I think they chose their champion, but they kind of chose wrong, because he was saying what he wanted to say through the film. And so in that moment, sometimes you get those beautiful moments where, like, the country is pushing a filmmaker to say something, and the actual message they get is not the one they want, but it's the one that was right on time. And I feel like Bay's ubiquity, right, over the last like decade, like, he is like one of the champions. Like, aside from Marvel, whose films have been seen more, really? Right. Like, in the last however many, you know, I know more people that would have seen every single Transformers like 10 times, and they may never have seen 2006 Miami Vice. So I think it's like, there's a few like critics have talked about like, no, Bay is my American film. It's not. Yeah. It's not David Fincher. Like, forget it. It's not. Right. It's not David Fincher. And British films, not Chris. You know, might not be like Christopher Nolan or whatever. It's like, it's who is that dominant? You know, it's probably Steve Kloves and David Yates. You know, all the Harry Potter movies. Like, that. That's British cinema. Sorry, I don't care what you say. Like, that's it. You know what I mean? Right. Like, it. So yeah, it's really funny how you can't choose your champion. And also, I just have to say, I was watching Six Underground 2, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I saw it in a cinema with my friends. And I was watching it for like 30 seconds. And when a pigeon hits a nun in a face, slow motion, I was like, this is the best movie I've ever seen. He's a master. He's a genius. It's like, he, in a movie that can actually have feelings and thoughts and anxieties, he's still a master of, like, I don't know, like this kind of gonzo excess. That's just brilliant. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
You mentioned the theory about the time and the imagery.
Yes.
There's a key point that always sticks out in my mind of Six Underground. It's the part in the beginning, the chase sequence where, they're doing the chase, and a person gets, as they're escaping the bad guys, they make the bad guy crash, and you see the body fly out of the car, like, into like a debris. But I can't explain this. The camera lingers just a half or fraction of a second longer than you normally would do that in that shot.
Yes.
So you can kind of just enough time to register that is a human body being mangled beyond recognition.
Yes.
But just that split second. And it's stopping the tracks. The rest of the movie keeps going at his breakneck pace. But just that moment, I'm like, this guy's a fucking god. Like, how did he see that? You know, and that's the whole movie. It's like just stopping for that brief moment to recognize the inhumanity of what you're doing. To keep going with it anyway.
Yeah. Right. He understand. I fundamentally think that Michael Bay's movies do not understand humans, like the way people talk to each other, emotion. But no one is better at understanding mechanics than him. And like the way, like, it might, the mechanics of a human body, like flying out of a car might be, or like the way, you know, two cars racing on a bridge might be, like, he understands like machines and the mechanics of action, like, I think better than anyone.
I know the listeners are like, why the fuck is Michael Bay for? And I promise you guys, all these points, as this happens, they will relate to the Miami Vice in totality.
We love digressions on this podcast, and we love like the movies that we end up talking about on this podcast, which were like, how do we start talking about Scream, you know, Underground? Like, it always ends up being something interesting, but it's like the conversation about how we get there is super interesting. But
yes,
if we want to get to Miami Vice,
we have to. Let's dive in. We're going to do in the spirit of it, after a great conversation with Emma Stefanski on a previous show, we shared the German trailer for Miami Vice and we got to watch it together. Vice hasn't heard that yet. You will hear that on the upcoming episode, but we're gonna unpack a couple of choice scenes with Vice and get his color commentary and his incisive unpacking of them together. But first, as you, as an individual, what's your Michael Mann movie? Because I would imagine just because, funnily enough, after One Heat Minute, I've spoken to so many Australian military professionals and police officers who have encountered the show, and they're like, Heat is their favorite movie. That is their favorite movie, which I can totally understand. And that scene of the bank shootout is one of their favorite action scenes they've ever seen. So I'm wondering how you came to Mann, and is it a bit backwards? Are you a Miami Vice fan before a Heat fan? How do you come to the cinema of Michael Mann?
They showed that scene of the bank robbery and the getaway and the shootout of Heat in my basic training class. The commander was like, "This is a proper technique for how you bound to cover."
Wait, in which class?
Basic training, Katie.
Oh,
basic.
My God.
That's how powerful it was, the impact it has.
Okay, that's so, why the Everybody Loves Heat. There you go.
Because it really is. I mean, in all honesty, it is a textbook showcase of the bonding movements. So which is to say, I was in love with Heat before then when I saw it as a young teen, before I joined the Army. And for me, you know, I am a big gangster ass movie, TM quote, Mr. trademark, aficionado as well. So I always love when military or tactical films and gangster films kind of coincide, which has happened a lot throughout history. And there's some elements of that in Heat as well. But you know, I love the, you know, it's of course, you know, all young red blooded males of America love the Heat. You know, the Pacino, De Niro, the, you know, all the guns and the grim faces, you know, great ass, you know, all that. It's in our DNA. So that was the first one. But then, of course, so yeah, that's probably my primary entryway, the biggest one of all. But then I did appreciate Miami Vice when it came out. When it came out, it was 2006, right?
Yes.
So I was on my way, finishing my first Korea tour on the way to Germany/Iraq. And so I had missed it in its theatrical run, but I saw it, you know, video. And then I appreciated that. I appreciated the efficiency, the kind of, the similar to his, you know, the Heat's efficiency that the other professionals doing the focus mission, but just kind of seeing the scope of it all. I had never really watched the Miami Vice show in its prime, in its heyday. I was a little too young for that. But I understood, I kind of recognized the tropes of it all. I knew, was familiar with it. And so I was familiar enough to kind of, well, you guys have talked before how people say the movie and the show are very totally different, but they actually have a lot of similarities, especially the later seasons to the movie now. But just in a general sense, I appreciated that update, that the newer scene, the newer veneer, the newer the remodeling of those older 80s crime aesthetics to this new kind of international crime syndicate globalized world we're living in. And then as we'll get into later, also, you know, being overseas myself for most of my career, I kind of appreciated that international aspect of it, as well as the I didn't know it at the time, but now I have better words to articulate it. I kind of, what really got to me about Vice is the security and defense apparatus underlying all of this world that I've been a part of now. So I kind of have a little bit of window into that and to see how it affects how this global high tier stuff affects this guy in a trailer park, crooked meth, or this T2 cops going in hard, you know, how I've lived and seen this, the grand scale affecting the local close-up view. So that's, so over time, I've appreciated that more and more about Miami Vice, and also in other ways, how that in turn influence other films now in this post 9/11 landscape, which I yeah, it's really fascinating that it kind of stays alive in that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, some people know, but it actually wasn't the Star Wars minute that directly influenced One Heat Minute in its construction, how I wanted to do it. I just found out about the Star Wars minute afterwards and then, you know, obviously gave them credit because they're the original text. What actually influenced me the most to do it was a thing called Cinema Interruptus, which is Roger Ebert in person would break down classic films. He did it with Citizen Kane. I believe he did it in like a Colorado festival. He would go there on a yearly basis and he would break down movies. So what we're going to do right now for everyone who's listening is we're going to play Vice Interruptus, right? We're going to be here with Vice. We're going to go to two key scenes. We're going to go to the first scene where our guys pretend to be Haitians and they do a maneuver to break in, steal a Jose Euro load of drugs to acquire them for their future play that's going to happen. And we'll hear Vice break that down. And then we can jump into the final scene. But we're going to just, Vice, whenever you want, I'm going to just let you hit stop, pause, and we can break some further things down. But I think this might be fun to do. I'm going to play around with it so you guys can hear it see it. And you guys listening at home, prepare for Vice Interruptus as part of Miami Nice.
Low, this is?
Hey, man, Bushu.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
That's a great shot.
That's a Michael Bay shot.
Yeah. But like all handheld or Steadicam.
Yeah.
Well, I gotta give some context for you and everybody listening. Most of my time in the Army, I was a intel support guy. I was never out in the field. I was no Rambo or anything like that. You know, I was never like doing like any kind of kicking down doors, or whatever. But part of the analysis and the information part of it was having to watch these and also like help coordinate or follow along as it happened to provide intel on the spot. And so I had the precision of this assault, the and the force, the violence of it, the calculated, it's the how do I say it, the calculated application of overwhelming brutality. So we kind of we're seeing here, it's like you have this, you have to move in with this force of action, the violence of action they call it, to get the prop to make this smoother, like so you know, like as opposed to like other for conventional heist movies or heists in general, like if you guys took up a robbery in a store or whatever, they kind of, it's erratic and they kind of wave the gun around, everybody on the floor, they're kind of moving more with the intimidation of verbally or so to do so, whereas the intimidation here is the actual violence itself. There's no threat of violence, it is the violence,
right? They don't warn you, we're gonna do this to you, they just come in and do it.
Yes.
yeah
and the speed of it all, that shock, the shock and all, as they say. That's the so critical of it all, of especially you know, this, oh, and this movie's high level of criminal activity, you know, because as you saw, you guys were armed to the teeth as well. So at any moment, at the moment that they lost the initiative of that entry, they would have been killed right immediately.
Yeah.
So they had so it's critical to have that violence of action in his movements.
So does this look like stuff that you watched?
Yeah, and I think. Well, I'll probably come back to you over the course of this conversation. That not just myself either. Over the years, there's been either through soldiers' own personal videos or movies, documentaries, like most famously Restrepo and a sequel, yes. Corn Gall.
Uh-huh.
We have we have this data. We have this historical document now of what modern war looks like now from the eyes of the soldiers, thanks to, you know, smaller cameras, YouTube, all that kind of stuff.
You kind of
see the beginnings of that. Well, the beginnings of our understanding of that, of this modern context in this movie, like the shot with the, as the truck goes into the, you know, it's a camera, yeah, on the truck going, moving forward into the load.
It's almost like you're embodying your reversing camera. I don't know if you've ever driven a car that's got a reversing camera, but it's like, yeah, in the reversing, yeah, camera, and like watching, yeah, that as you're ramming through the door after the gunshot that, yeah, with the shotgun.
So yeah, so this is, it's not quite first person, but rather it's almost as if, because a lot of the shots you'll see throughout the movie, when they have the violence of action, when they have their guns drawn, it's directly, you see the full profile, them holding the gun. People can't see the camera, of course, but you see the cameras directly in front of them, looking at how, it's looking at not the gun or not what they're doing, but it's looking at how they're acting and reacting to these moments. And it's very similar to if a lot of not just soldier first person camera, but war journalists, they're like, mm-hmm, if you've seen like footage from Syria or Iraq and Afghanistan itself, from the journalist perspective, as they're watching the people, combatants or civilians or whoever is fighting, is that very same similar moment, trying to seeing how they look doing these actions.
Yeah, there's like the camera operator, clearly a handheld camera operator, but it's like some.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Feels like you're in the scene with them, that you're with them, that you're participating in the action with them. It's eye level, you know, or it's like the height of what a human being is. I mean, you're looking over the shoulder, you're looking at the table, you're kind of right one step behind them. So you're it gives you this sense of having a camera on your shoulder, like a body cam or something, or holding a camcorder or whatever. It gives that visceral sense of being in the moment and just capturing this footage.
Yeah, so yeah, that's definitely and I think we'll talk about this in another scene, but so one of my, I guess if I had a thesis to my appearance here on the show, is how Michael Mann is such an integral part of our vocabulary of action over the past few years, action specifically, and how, and kind of the ongoing quest to how to make action more refined and better throughout the years. So you know, this is like I think this was What year was the first Bourne film? I think it was 2003, right? Something like that.
Yeah, 2002, 2003.
Oh, yeah. It was a direct... So, you know, this is in that midst there of Bourne, so where you can have that kind of revolution of the shaky cam or the up-close, realistic, tactical action, right?
Mm.
And so in this case, you know, Mann is doing his version of that. But of course, it's all at once more raw and more refined too, because, you mm-hmm. know, as you guys, I'm sure you guys spoke about this many a time, his choice to go digital, purely digital on camera. And I think at the time it might have felt too gauche or whatever, but now with our context and history of all this footage of war, it feels right in line with that time frame. This is a mid-2000s hot World War and terror film, yes. Even though it's a cop movie. I've talked about this more recently, how in the most recent years, there's a big emphasis or a big manifestation of video game aesthetics and yes. Principles to film, but in a really like kind of high level prestige way, even 1917. That's a first person action game or whatever.
Yeah. Right. So, totally. Yeah,
and the dialogue between video game aesthetic and movie aesthetic is ongoing, because I once read an amazing thesis that Travis Bickle holding weapons when he goes and buys his weapons the first time in Taxi Driver is the first person shot we receive. So no one can see what I'm doing, but that whole view of when you see someone's arm down to the gun as they're pointing, like Scorsese orchestrates that shot, and like literally you could pick that shot up and you could put it in any first person shooter you've ever seen since, and it's like they are just the same language. So there is a dialogue happening between these two mediums.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you get this kind of, you're seeing these first moments of how film would in turn modify the more recent video games that again, in turn, influence the movies. So in this case, see, like, there's one specific movie that I always refer to that people kind of laugh at me about. Act of Valor came out, I think it was
2012. I've seen Act of Valor. Yeah. Have you seen it, Katie?
I don't think I have. Wait, let me look it up.
It's an action film about a group of Navy SEALs.
Yes.
And the whole draw is that these are actual real life Navy SEALs portraying, you know, versions of themselves. So they're doing the actual movements or the actual gun choreography, fight choreography. They're all doing it themselves because they know how to do it in real life.
Right.
If I could speak crassly, just for the briefest of moments, Act of Valor is a little bit like a porn film in that all of the story kind of sucks because they have to strip away their natural charm and the way that they actually interact to like create this artificial story. But when they are doing the action
in motion, yeah,
it is like sensational. Like it's right. Just like the Michael Mann talks about it. Funnily enough, with Ali the most, and he's a bit of an obsessive about this, like training someone so that they can even walk the right walk for a film. And these guys just, it's like, they're like live creatures. They just move like in different ways than normal people move. They interact, they intuit things. Yeah, it's that Act of Valor, if you just cut out some of those, you know, centerpiece scenes of the movie, they look amazing. They look incredible.
And so one of the key things in that movie is that it has that, it's not just the first person camera, but it's like the camera on the gun itself, on the weapon itself.
Yeah.
The kind of refined, it's appeared in movies before that, but it actually truly refined and made it like usable because, you know, it's using digital cameras that are small enough, but also powerful enough to capture the movements. But, you know, again, kind of replicating that first person shooter in a game form, but now it's applied to real life / film. So it gives it its own like kind of sense of immersion. And I kind of see that. I kind of see the beginnings of that in this scene here, and in some of the scenes in throughout Men of Vice. That kind of, like I said, the camera is facing them instead of the target itself. But it's still that same sensation of the weapon is the camera, but in this case, it's just the camera is on them instead of their targets. But it's still it's the camera too, like they're holding it too, like that. And so you kind of see the beginnings of that here in this shot of that close up. Immersion to a degree, because it's also like there is a bit of a even though it's so powerfully inside, there is still a bit of a remove from it, in that it's hard to explain. It's like you're in the situation with them, see them with this dangerous tactical stuff, but there's never a point where unlike a lot of power fantasy movies, there's never a point, at least for me, there you think that, oh, I could do this. No. You're watching professionals.
Yes.
Do their thing with them, but the remove is you could not do this.
No.
Right. You're sort of like like tagging along. That's how I kind of feel watching these scenes. Like you're right over the shoulder of someone, or you're kind of like looking at them shooting. Like I kind of feel like I'm just sort of like the sidekick.
But I was just going to say one thing that he does. And I'd love to hear how you talk about it, is the way that the impression that I get in the scene and the way that I think he anchors the scene for the viewer, because, you know, some people are maybe want to be more engaged with that they can be doing this, is he's so good at giving you their mini objectives in the pace of the action. So the first objective is the lock, and then the second objective is the door. And then there's the hilarious one is like, do we even believe that they wouldn't know the accents up until this point? Of course they did, but it's just like whoever decided that that was a good line to do is amazing, because that's just like a perfect character choice. Shows you how good they are, that like they can just decide on a dime that they're going to speak Haitian and Rico can speak Haitian like effortlessly, right? But that there's that moment where they look, then we get in and we see the load on the table. And then there's that even better thing. It like scans to the two or three guys who are scrambling in shock once the doors blow open. And then the camera goes to the AK. So it's like charting what the objectives that they have to get to break this room. And I cannot get over this quote that you said, which is the calculated application of overwhelming brutality. That,
is that a military quote?
It might be a Vice TM. I've got Vice TM written here.
Well, honestly, I don't remember, because I read, after reading so many FMs and manuals, I'm not sure if it's a something someone wrote for a bullet point when is for a bullet point for a reward, or if it's something I kind of realized that they were doing.
Yeah. It sounds kind of like it has that almost clinical, like governmental language.
I'm sorry.
In my book, it says Vice TM. Okay. That's what in my notepad, it says Vice TM.
I have to apologize. Sometimes this stuff doesn't really leave you. It's been
no. Right. No. And that's what, when you said it, I was like, oh, is that like actually an American military tactic? And maybe it's just the way that you describe it, but that's what it sounds like. And obviously you're steeped in that world. So that's
sounds like sounds our like. Sounds like our podcasting tactics, Katie. Just calculated application of overwhelming brutality.
It's an amazing quote. It's an amazing quote. So I love it.
Well, here, let me. I have one more point to this scene, and to kind of build off that point itself is. Do you guys? I don't know if you ever have you seen or used the Internet Movie Firearm Database (IMFDB).
No,
Katie, I have only because. I kept getting DMs about it when I was doing Heat. Because they went, they said, you should go to the IMFDB because you can see all the weapons. Because I was curious. I think at some point someone had heard me say, I've got to research where to find what that actual weapon was. Because we were talking about another point in the film. Mm-hmm. And I went on there to learn about Val Kilmer's sniper rifle and the assault rifles mm-hmm. they used and Vincent's shotgun and Vincent's assault rifle and all those different things, you know.
Yeah, so this movie is a treasure trove of like the nerd the nerd specs for guns, and you know, that Michael Mann has that that's one of his qualities he has on his belt, is that there's a certain, not just tactical, but tactile. Like these are real objects. These are real physical machines, that complex machines that do these functions. And a gun. Not well. At a certain point, a gun is just a gun. You know, they all do the same thing, but different guns have different uses, different purposes, different situations. And I think Mann gets that really well. There's a reason why you would use a shotgun or instead of a rifle at certain points. You know, and there's a basic ballistic scientific reason why, and he gets that here, but at the same time he also gets to indulge in the this is a cool fucking gun. So you see the object they use to blast open the Glock, that's a HK Heckler Koch, it's a HK 69A1 grenade launcher. It's a single barrel, you can single load, can open the breech, put the grenade shell in and fire. But kind of an update of the old M79 grenade launcher we see in Vietnam films. It's a more modern version of that. But in this case,
we're gonna have to link this.
But in this case, what you see, like in that shot, or the actual like literal shot, it's a shrapnel, and you're like, wait, what do you use? So they have instead of a grenade round, an explosive round, they have rounds that are just full of buckshot and or shrapnel or metal pieces that fire. So it's basically one big ass shotgun instead of a grenade launcher.
Yeah. So,
and this will come into play in later scenes.
I'm going to start queuing this up. So Vice, do we want to breach? Are we going to breach a meth lab? or are we going to have a showdown with the Aryan Brotherhood and Jose Euro to wrap up your Vice Interruptus and unpacking of these great tactical scenes?
Let's go for the showdown at the end.
Yes. It is 1 hour, 48 minutes, 15 seconds into Miami Vice. If you're streaming it, we're currently watching it on Prime on my screen as we're about to share. So if you want to queue it up, get ready. But basically, the boys are in the car. Ricardo's about to start talking. They're going to do their ever so memeable and shareable, like, bash of hands together. And so here we go.
Location got changed. Bojean Shipyard, 27th and the River.
This guy is great, a creepy fuck. I love it.
Yes. his name is like Tom Towels or Tony Towels or something like that.
If I saw him in the street, I would look the other way. That's a scary white
yeah,
guy.
He's a scary, scary. And so tall. So tall.
Okay.
I love the color of the night. So we've talked about it a lot.
I know. The like brownish cloud.
Yeah. That's Katie on Action Film Twitter, just lurking under a camouflage.
I see everything.
Well, yeah, I'll talk while they do the dialogue.
Yeah.
Just kind of, even now, just the way the cinematography is and the movement, this is a new type of setup, a new type of, we're going to go to the meeting, like the darkness, the low light. This is like, they're moving on to the objective. This is a calculated assault. Yes. Not just meet up, just shoot out. Like, even, you know, you're the chief here. Like, it's a counter sniper. If you know, action, there's all type of operations going on at once, coordinated between both the villains and our heroes.
Right, there are many layers of interactions happening here.
Yeah, so we've got the delivery of the boats, we've got the assault there from the Aryan Brotherhood, and like you said, the counter assault at the same time.
Somebody from my side lays eyes on the money.
This low angle is so interesting to shoot that from that.
I'm loving. I money's like when right they're crossing here too, Katie. I'm so loving watching them cross over in the scene.
Can't find the shoes if they're so.
Yeah, the very Chewbacca with the night vision.
Yeah. And not, yeah, that's important here too. It's not just night. It's just specifically infrared vision. Like again,
infrared. Okay.
This is our modern. This is the the fallout of all the technology in the war here in our streets.
I love that even at night, we can see how cool Jose Euro's shirt is.
I love Colin here. He's so mad.
Catch a movie and grab a bite.
God, this
nostrils
sucks.
Flared.
When I get tired, I throw her away.
God, this is such a good scene.
Place so good. Else.
Did you guys ever see that?
See, right now, he's not Sonny Crockett. He's a Coral.
Anyway,
right now.
Yes, he is. Straight Velcro mode.
Listen, you can't say that it's Velcro. When Velcro goes ham, he's only Sonny, all right? Colin's not there. Colin's not there. We have to remember. Colin's off the mat.
Just the raw machismo rage. That's all. Yeah.
I love this.
What difference does it make, Sonny?
Listen to me, asshole. I do not want that motherfucker near me. You want to see
or do I?
That's that line is all for Vice. I do not want that motherfucker in me.
Nah.
God, all these guys look great. Like their combination of actual undercover.
What does she think she's gonna accomplish? Beating up that guy.
She probably could have slapped him a week ago in front of Jesus and he wouldn't have been able to do anything. But yeah, I love these faces.
The casting.
It's just always great, especially for these other folk.
Yeah, like I was saying, even with all this post-G-Watt technical stuff, it's still a cop movie. There's still, you know, a guy from The Wire here. There's still these like stone-faced henchmen from the 80s here. In the badge suits. It's still... Miami Vice, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just at night. It's not bright. But there's killer suits are still there. The machismo's there.
You're so right. It feels profoundly militaristic and post-9/11 militaristic. Yeah. Dom.
Just the language of, I love through the sniper's scope. Sniper, sniper scope. Infrared tag, next one.
Those off-kilter close-ups are so, like, later man to me.
Yes.
Loud.
Wow.
Shot in the back. Oh, yeah.
Shotgun through the back of the car. You just love the cops are already like that. The zombie cop team immediately into the tactics. They're like, where the other guys are scrambling because they're getting gunfire from multiple locations. And then the blood spatter on the lens.
Also, see, this weapon here is the Patriot Arms. It's a if you refer back to the IMD FPD, it's a modified type of M4 assault rifle. That's yes. A compact. I think, and in this case, again, the tactileness of it.
Yes.
This is kind of showing that these are like, well, from the dunes, you know, like that's not something you get on the street regularly. Like this is like most like back in even like with Die Hard, you know, remember Die Hard with the. And the big blonde guy, he had the style, AUG, the bullpup, yes. The magazine goes to the back instead of the front. Like that to kind of signify these are higher end goons. Like just do the hardware. It's all here too.
Such a great note.
It is so tactile because you can see the blood on the lens and the bullet casings shooting out of that thing.
Yes. Yeah. All right, let's hit play. 153, 28, 29, 30, here we go. One of my favorite tactical movies.
See the bullet casings?
Yeah, casings coming out of the side.
And also, those here, I think...
different muscle pressure. Sorry, boss, go ahead.
Well, no, with heat, you know, it was a little more crisper, kind of to show that, to emphasize that they were more professionals. Here, it's a little more purposely chaotic, purposely, like, stayed. Like, people are staying in cover on purpose. They're waiting. Now you have the bounding. Not until they start... Not until they fixed the enemy that they started the bounty for.
Like, yeah, it feels so much messier than heat, than the heat shootout, yeah.
But you know, it's like, yeah, just having that extra element to it because they are in a certain, not outgunned, but like, these are like this giant G3 rifle. Like, this is not like small arm, or it's not pea shooters. These are like well armed, well funded people, so they had to like act accordingly.
I love Thoreau here, this when he gets clipped and the roll.
Combat roll.
Love that.
Oh yeah,
that's like straight up Martin Riggs, straight out of Lethal Weapon. Love it.
Yeah, the combat roll is not in any FM that I've read.
And I haven't even said it yet, but Thoreau's hair is very Martin Riggs too. Got a big Martin Riggs energy.
Oh, look at him! He's doing his battlefield medic.
Kind of want to pause it for here, just to,
yeah.
Because this is again part of the newer understanding of. Violence as we see it in real life or as we go through it in post-war and terror. One of the biggest, maybe the biggest development that saved lives was the tourniquet, the handheld tourniquet.
Yeah.
I still have mine actually. It's we had them all in our field medical kits. And the whole thing was that for the longest time, the conventional wisdom was that a tourniquet, if you put a tourniquet on, it meant you would lose your arm or whatever, you'd lose that limb. But, you know, with the advances of field hospitals and surgical medicine, that was no longer the case. And people found that just in general, throughout all kinds of armed conflict or firearm conflicts, the leading loss of life was blood loss. And so it was a kind of pretty significant cultural change where we kind of all had to learn how to use our tourniquets to apply. And the device itself is a kind of polyethylene kind of a plastic thing, Velcro, really easy to put on. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he's put on a belt, but like, it's not just like, oh, I'm gonna put my towel or put my towel over my hand or cover it. Like, he's like, no, he's like, I'm gonna stop the bleeding because we know now, like, that's really the killer, not just like, you know, getting the whole body of like, you're just gonna bleed out and like die pitifully. Like, so just again, the tactile understanding of modern
and conflicts. He reacts instantly, so there's no hesitation, there's no oh my god, I got shot. It's like
he's
highly trained
that, you know?
People who are reacting as they've been trained and just muscle memory and not thinking about it.
Yes,
so you know, it's not just the guns, it's the whole
the whole piece of fabric is working.
Yes. All right, let's finish this off because I really want to see this big guy get it. And so we love Elizabeth here, like firing from behind.
She's
these giant
such a
tires.
Badass yeah, in this movie.
And then when this is.
What kind of gun is that?
Sig 5.5 50.
You don't have. We can figure it out later.
We can figure it out. But yeah, this is that when she catches the shining badge. Gosh, I love this. I love how Euro's guy's like, get out of here, you idiot. Like,
I know, he comes out like, meh, meh. And they're like, no, you're not the guy who does this. You're like the middle manager. Whoa.
Great.
There it is.
Jesus. Wow.
Jackson Pollock. There we go.
Was that a 50 caliber?
That was the grenade launcher
that they blew the door open.
Oh yeah. My God. Grenade launcher to the tum-tum.
But again, remember, it's not the grenade itself. It's the shrapnel shell. It's full of buckshot, basically.
Yeah.
But in a grenade size, it's, yeah.
Yeah.
We've done all this action dissection, but let's just quickly watch the devastated Gong Li as Isabella running up to Sunny to wallop him for the realization that he's undercover this whole time and he's lied to her, because it's one of my most heartbreaking scenes in this movie. My goodness. Look at the fallout.
Who are you?
And I love that this whole scene really hasn't had any score to speak of.
Yeah.
You know, like up until this moment. And
he really goes. Yeah.
He's rolling around.
Yeah.
I love this.
I also watched. Oh, God.
The slow-mo catch.
Oh, right in the Achilles.
I love he stops the fight to just brace. There we go.
Oh.
Double headshot. Wow. All
right,
let's we can pause that right now. I think we've done the Lord's work there.
Yes. Well, per the sound, like I was also rewatching the Trudy rescue from the meth lab or whatever, and it's so quiet. And I really appreciate that because it makes the violence feel really realistic and grounded and visceral and real. And like, it's like, this is what it would sound like if you were strangling someone. This is what it would sound like letting the gunshots be the foreground of the soundtrack. And then, you know, and just being like, this is what this would be like. And then, you know, when we have this emotional moment, the score comes in. And I think that's a really cool choice.
There's two other things as well, which is Vice, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, is because the fact that they don't use music cues to tell us how we should be thinking, feeling during this quite chaotic exchange. I just think it's so intuitive and frenetic, and it feels so organic, like it's organically moving from one person to the other, one position to the next, one part of one side's firing, the other responding, etc. It just feels so organic. And then you get to there's just these couple of stylized moments, like Rico splattering, Jose, like Jackson Pollock against the wall. And then this shot where like he has to wrestle Isabella to the ground to avoid this gigantic, scary Aryan Brotherhood leader from shooting them both. And then he gets to get the reprise on getting back, and take sort of vengeance for Alonzo, but also protect them. I love that. That feels like the most stylized moments of the scene, but the rest of it is so urgent and so crazy and chaotic that it just all comes together perfectly.
Yeah, like even there at that moment when during that final face-off, again, with the video game language, you see over the third person over the shoulder, the zoom of the camera is the focus, is replicating his eyes focus, or in other words, or in game terms, you got to push the left trigger, flip his right trigger, the left trigger zooms in.
Yes.
That's him pushing the left trigger to zoom in. Hit that close-up shot, and the camera's replicating that sensation of that, down the barrel. Again, never been in a firefight, so I never been shot at. Well, no, I was gonna say, I didn't have to go to Iraq to be in a hostile urban environment. I'm from New York, born in Brooklyn, Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx, Brooklyn is, you know, like, I know what it is. So that all said, though, it's like,
I love how you're comparing Iraq, downtown Iraq, to Brooklyn, because I don't doubt you, but this is where it's so foreign to me, and maybe more relevant to you and Katie, is like, if there is a gun, if someone has a gun in Australia, like post 1997 in the street, like that's insane.
There's
thing.
No guns in Australia.
No guns. There's guns. But the control of the guns and the procedures around the guns and all of the rigmarole around guns, like, and also then there can be gun violence, but like if cops find guns in your house, like, you'll, especially if anything that's not meant to be there, there's a long jail sentence for even having trafficking in weapons you shouldn't own. So it's a very very interesting contrast.
Well, the part about the motion behind it. I guess maybe you should have watched the Meth House, because, but in that case, again, all the kind of, it comes together there as well. It's mostly silent, like you said. Then when Rico breaks into the house, the focus is on him, his face. Mm. It's specifically on him, the gun, but his face. And you see him in like kind of real time twitching, the fast twitch parts of his mind and body going, assessing the targets as they come. So then, of course, in that scene where the first is like the teenager with the switchblade or whatever, kills for him, takes him down. And then the bigger guy, like he's, you can see him, the gears turning in his face, of all these tactical options or reactions he must consider, and then but also he's also like fucking terrified because that's his girl, so all that anxiety and adrenaline coming together, and this like kind of, again, the controlled chaos of this violence that he must master to get out safely, to get everyone out safely, and also complete his mission.
But it is interesting because like you could say that they're applying that same credo to the meth lab scene, the rescue scene, the what is it, controlled brutality, overwhelming
calculated application of overwhelming brutality.
Yes, that's what he's doing. I mean, he like has the pizza box, but he's gonna shoot him, you know, so it's like you know, he does have to be careful because Trudy's in there, but they're going to go in with that brutality number one.
Yeah. And because they have to do that. It's a survival thing. If they don't, they will die.
The one note that just knocks me for six in that scene, also when I watch it again, is when there is the person who is taken down with the blade and they're still writhing on the ground, and that distraction cannot be abided. So he just shoots him in the head and just looks back up and is immediately like, I have one less problem. Now this tactical, and as Vice was depicting, you guys can't see, but it was fun for Katie and I, because like Vice talking about him calculating everything in his field of vision to actually like go, where is my tactical advantage here? But like taking that person out who's writhing on the floor means that I've got less targets there. But man, we could talk for another 5 hours, but I think this is the perfect moment for us to say, Vice, this has just been brilliant. You being on Miami Nice is extra Miami Nice. Thank you so much. This has been such a blast. Again, like we said, we're huge admirers of everything we do. Katie, the lurker. I'm probably more the mullet wearing Justin Theroux that swaggers in now and then. I just want to say thank you and the whole community that you are part of, that Action Film Twitter, those guys that jumped off BMD and exist in their own world online and all that sort of stuff. We love you guys, and we're fans of having really thoughtful conversations about action, and you're kind of you're the squad leader, my man. You're the squad. Yes. You're orchestrating. You're like in the nicest possible way. You're like our Barry Shabaka Henley right now. You know, like you're like fire.
No, I'm the fat kid in the chair, like a Spider Man. I'm the fat kid in the chair. That's
all. No, never. We're so grateful for your insights and for joining us, because I feel like a lot of people are gonna have a great time listening to this chat. So, do you want to plug anything while we've got you here, just in the wrap up of the show?
I've been on a podcast recently with my friends Liam O'Donnell and Mike, they run the Atkins podcast.
Yes.
And then we're trying out something new in the coming weeks. It's kind of a weekly, if we can get so action roundup, kind of the action Twitter experience. in podcast form.
Fun.
Just keep an eye on the Atkins Undisputed podcast format.
And this is the one that Atkins himself has endorsed and been on.
Well, it's to the Atkins Undisputed is endorsed and recreated by Atkins himself. But in this case, we're trying to do like a spinoff with Liam O'Donnell of the Skyline franchise fame.
Yes.
So we're trying to do something like that.
So what's that? What's the name of that podcast again? So we can keep an eye out for it.
So we've decided that's going to be called Action for Everyone.
Action for Everyone. Yeah, I'm going to listen.
If you thought we
lurked now, you just wait till there's a podcast we can lurk on.
I know.
We'll be
it's
there.
Pretty important to us that, you know, everybody is welcome and everybody has a say in these conversations because, well, this is my soapbox. Real quickly, you know, like the conversation of film is so insular. Even now, I think only certain people get the bullhorn, and it's only a certain set of people and culture that this conversation affords. That's kind of why I'm doing this. Like I said, I'm just motherfucking, you know, here from New York, just talking shit. But like, I'm part of this culture too.
Yes.
Or not, you know?
Yes. And we cannot, that's not in dispute on this show, my man. We are big fans of what you do, and we're fans of really any of the voices out there that have thoughtful conversations about these things, and also know how to have funny and silly conversations about these things as well. So we're a big fan. But we will do the links. I'll make sure that when you guys are listening to this, you can hit the descriptions, and all the links to Vice and everything that he does online is there. But look, thank you so much, man, for making this Miami Vice.
Indeed. And thank you so much, Vice. And seriously, that Transformers essay or whatever it is.
Bring it on, baby.
It's something. I need this Transformers personal essay.
Listen, you write the essay, okay? The long form essay. Katie will edit it. We'll get it. We've got some friends. It's gone straight to Brightwall Darkroom, the Vice essay. I'm going to talk to Chad, who's the editor, and we'll talk to Travis. We'll get it up there. And then you can read it out and I'll turn it into a podcast, right? and so then that's the plan.
Thanks for sharing all your expertise and your experience. It just really made this so much richer of a discussion. So amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, again, thank you again for your support and everything. And I'm just, thank you for reaching out. Just happy to be here. That's great.
Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often 1 minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.